Recording made by the Tanaw Historical Society, and our speaker is a longtime Alaskan trapper and journalist, Charlie Mays.
Here.
Everything has a reason. My reason for going on a trap line is very much the same as that of every other trapper. The desire to get out from under the overseer's whip, to be my own man, to be shut of the labor market. And I chose Alaska because I was tired of the distraction of tearing my britches on barbed wire. I was, in other words, an escapist, and still am. For years before setting myself up in business, I had a fond, and quite false, as it turned out, vision of sitting comfortably beside my cabin door in the bright sunshine and watching the river go by, free from worries and free from care. To make a long story less tedious, things failed to work out as I had anticipated. Truth to tell, I have never worked harder and been less rewarded in my life than when on the trap line. Talk about 40, 60, 80-hour weeks. The trapper knows no such. He works the clock around and often far into the night. People have asked me why I ever decided to come to Alaska, why I ever went into the boonies in the first place. Well, James Oliver Curwood had something to do with it, and Jack London, and of course, Robert W. Service. Curwood was a northern writer, a novelist, who had his place in the literary sun sometimes after World War I. His first book that I read, borrowed from a neighbor, was Bree, the Son of Kazan. Later I got my grubby little mitts on to Kazan. And in fact, when I was outside recently, I found both these books in a second-hand store in Seattle and succumbed to the nostalgic compulsion of picking them up. They went through a great many editions before they dropped from the publisher's list. I don't think I need much say much about Jack London or Robert W. Service. But anyway, they were responsible for turning my thoughts northward. Details, if enumerated, would be tedious, but it wasn't until 1949 that I was able to bring this trap line thing about. After buttonholing every trapper I could contact, I decided that probably the best thing for me to do was bow out some trapper. I thought that this would eliminate loss of time and might possibly avoid conflict with other trappers. I'm still pretty much convinced that I was right in this theory. I didn't come up here as green as I might have been. I had read everything that I could lay hands on Alaska. I had talked, as I said, with many of the old-timers, and I had trapped since I was knee-high to a pup in the Missouri and western slope of Colorado. And I was fortunate in contacting Jim Berry, an old-timer who was on the Kuskokwim in the early 1900s. But I had only been on snowshoes briefly up to that time, and I'd never driven dogs. But I mastered the snowshoes without too much difficulty, although I took a few tumbles, still do in fact. I learned to let myself go when a fall is imminent and never had any serious trouble. As for the sled dogs, they worked out far better than I expected. They didn't give me much trouble. They proved good companions and willing workers for the most part. Of course, I had grown up with farm horses and was surprised to learn the similarity between workhorses and work dogs. The dog, of course, is a much smarter, more biddable, and more willing beast, but there is still a great similarity between the two, and even the harness is similar. As luck would have it, I wound up on Beaver Creek, about 90 miles by water from Beaver Village, with a main cabin and four overnight line cabins. I first went up there July 4, 1949. I had contacted the trap line owner, Dick Morris, by mail, and I chartered a little Piper Cub and had somebody from Fairbanks Flying Service, I think it was, fly me over to Beaver Village. Unfortunately, the wind was blowing a gale, and we couldn't travel up the Yukon River for a day or two, but we got away eventually and made landfall at the main cabin in due time. And as usual on such trips, we didn't see one head of game all the way up. Later, when we got out on the lakes in canoes, we saw very little. few rats or ducks even, although there were hundreds of them around, but we did see some beaver. But on that trip, boat trip, I learned one very important lesson. Dress warmly, even in summer on the rivers. I had a light rain parka and wore that, and did have the foresight to take along a pair of gloves, but I was far from comfortable, and we traveled mostly at night. Dick Morris was in his 60s then, I believe. He was a big, strong Skookum man, weighing 250 pounds or more, and from the number of worn-out snowshoes he had in his cache, I think he was very hard on them. But by that time, he had quite a hitch in his get-along, and was amenable to the idea of selling out. I sized up the situation as well as I could. Here he had a nice, almost new cabin, about 16 by 18. I think he had only spent one winter in it. It was roomy and well lighted, rather unusual for a trapper's cabin. It had four windows, four panes each, and he had a good radio, and that time radios were not cheap. And the windows were double windows. There was a freeze-proof cellar and two high caches. One of these he used for dog food. He had quite a stock of grub and ammunition on hand and pretty good set of cooking gear. The cabin was nice and clean. And I noticed in particular that Dick had soft, clean, white hands, so I decided that he was doing all right, and that was the layout for me. Dick had been in the U.S. Engineers in France in World War I. He drove mules to a wheel scraper, building roads and railroads most of the time, I think. He had been on that particular trap line for 28 years, and during that time he hadn't done a tap of work for anybody else. I questioned him about his trapping methods and wasn't too impressed. In fact, I thought my methods were better and still think so. He was Kansas-born, and I don't think had ever trapped before he came north. There was a goodly supply of firewood at the cabin site, split birch for the cook stove, and round, small spruce pole wood for the heater. I believe there was enough for 2 years or more, and that fact impressed me. From what I had heard and read, not a few deaths that occurred on the backwood trap lines were caused from lack of fuel. I think Dick was conscious of this, too. So I resolved that I'd never be caught without plenty of firewood. The only thing is, I piled several weeks' supply handy at the door. I figured that I could crawl out on hands and knees if necessary and get it. But if I had to go all the way to the wood pile, I might not make it there and back. I guess luck was with me. I never had any serious accident or sickness, but Dick was less fortunate. He once got down with a spell of rheumatism and couldn't even get out to feed his dog for quite a while. Luckily, some Indians came along and carried word down to his white trapper neighbors about 12 miles below. Later, he had his tonsils removed, I think, at the Fort Yukon Hospital and got all right in about 2 years or so. I don't know what his wood situation was at that time, but I suspect that even then he was cautious in this matter. It takes a lot of wood just to keep one reasonably comfortable when it's 50 and 60 below. A lot of fuel goes up the chimney in a very short while. And chopping or sawing or even splitting wood at this low temperature is not a comfortable pastime. I chose to be a loner. I think most Alaskan white trappers are. The Indians can't see the logic of a man being in the woods alone in winter, and they are perhaps right. But I never found anyone who could get along with me for any length of time, and vice versa. After a while, day after day, companionship palls. You know what your partner is going to say before he opens his stupid mouth, and he likewise. I've never forgotten a line of Horace Kephart's in his Camping and Woodcraft book. He said that you are in ecstasies admiring the sunset, your partner is sure to remark that it looked like it was going to rain. But getting back to Beaver Creek, time rocked along as it does. Some years I made expenses, but some years not. And on a very few occasions, put a little money in the bank. But there was a great fluctuation of the Fair Bear Earth's population. For several years, there were no links. Then a few came drifting in. Now the past 2 or 3 years, the rabbit cycle has been very low, and the lynx have been very few. Some years the rats were plentiful, and some years almost entirely absent, and it seems that when they were plentiful, the prices were always low. Dick Morris observed much the same thing, that when he made good catches of fur, the prices always went down to nothing. In time, I learned the animal crossings of the area and the most productive places to make sets. One of these I found was in the vicinity of a beaver house. It seems that lynx, mink, and fox will visit every lodge in the vicinity. Every moose will do this, even moose will do the same thing, but I never had any success with sets made around a beaver dam. Many of the best trap sets that are used outside are absolutely useless here in Alaska, especially interior Alaska, where it is almost all snow trapping. Of late years, I've been using more and more snares and fewer traps, but snares have their disadvantages too. I've never used many of the killer traps. Their disadvantage lies, in my experience at least, in being hard to set. I have not been able to do this without pulling off my at least one mitten, and that is something I hate to do, especially in cold weather. I have come to believe that a thermometer is a valuable piece of trap line equipment. Lately, 45 degrees below has been my maximum. If it is colder than that, I stay home and keep the fire warm. In times like this, one has the traps and snares working for him, so he can relax in the cabin. I think one stretches his luck too thin if he tries to operate in colder temperatures than 45 below. There is always something to be done, like stretching fur, repairing dog harness, or traps, or snowshoes, or sharpening knives, or cleaning guns, and sewing. It seems that a trapper must have a needle in his hands most all the time. My trap line years were those of mild adventure. I never got badly frozen, never got lost beyond the point of getting home again, eventually, never had any bad bear trouble, and never was treed by an irate moose, nor chased by wolves. In fact, wolves were very scarce in that part of the world for one reason or another. I once went through the ice, and for a while didn't know whether or not I was going to get out. Got my feet wet a time or two in the winter, but always carried dry foot gear and was so able to change. Had 2 canoe upsets, one of which was very expensive, but my life jacket saved me. Being alone, I tried to be sensible in my conduct and not take undue chances. A forest fire came very near wiping me out in 1953, but now the poplars and birch have grown back to where one could hardly tell that there was ever a fire through that country. People have asked me if it's not lonesome out in a place like that. Of course one is. But a trapper is always busy, and the loneliest place in the world, in my estimation, is in any large city, San Francisco or New York, for instance. I think it was in the late winter of 1965 that I faced up to a new and annoying situation. This particular area I had been able to cover in a day's time without stopping. But on this particular occasion, I had to sit down twice and rest. And for a good many nights, I'd gotten into camp so tired my face hurt. I've considered the mechanized dog. In my case, it would mean a lot of axe work in order to widen the trails. A toboggan is only something like 18 inches wide, a dog-drawn toboggan, that is. But a gas sled is 2 feet or more wide. And then there is the problem of snow piling down on it from laden trees and bushes, plus the possibility of mechanical failure, plus the fact that gas engines and I have been at odds a long while. I have had, over the years, a bit of correspondence with outside would-be trappers, and they all ask the unanswerable question, how much can I make there? Sometimes even good trappers, long habituated to the country, don't make their salt, so it is pretty certain that a raw outsider must come out the small end of the horn, as the fellow says, at least for the first season or two. The last good fur year, price-wise, was, I believe, 1946. Previously, Alaska Red Fox had sold for as much as $75, Martin $40 to $50, Link about the same. In 1946, Beaver brought $1 an inch, $65 inch blanket Beaver, $65. Trappers recall that fact fondly, but since 1946, prices have been down to almost nothing. Foxes some years were a drug on the market and practically unsaleable. Lynx bring $12 to $15. I have waited with such patience as I could for almost 20 years for the good prices to return. Now, I've given up. What with the change in fashion, the imported furs and synthetics, I'm now resigned to the fact that it is not likely to reoccur in my lifetime.
Why do you propose going riding this spring?
Well, I propose to go back to my trap line and rat as soon as water opens up in the spring, just to recapture some of the dreams that formerly I had, and perhaps, I don't know, it's beyond me to describe, really, but when the birds start coming north again, and the days get long, and it's really, really a good feeling to be out there on those lakes and let the rest of the world go by. I really never kept very much of a count on my traps. I probably had between 250 and 300, and probably 200 snares. But they were very seldom that I was ever able to get them all working at once. In other words, some areas might be good this year. You have your traps there. You don't carry them out of there. You leave them there from year to year. You hang them up in a tree during the summertime. And you just set them out again in the spring. So it's kind of hard to answer that question. But I always kept as many working as I could. And as to the length, well, I don't know. It took me 4 days to get from my main cabin up to what I call the hill cabin, which is the one farthest away. So it was possibly 60, 75 miles up there. Then I would run branch lines from these overnight cabins. So it would be possible to give you anything like an accurate mileage.
You have how many cabins?
I had four line cabins. And sometimes I used a tent. I had a tent that I could set up a camp, a temporary camp, most anywhere I wanted.
How many dogs did you have?
I used five one season, but four mostly. Four worked out best. Four handles real well. I figured one dog for the sled, one to break trail, one for the load, and one for me.
How many lines did you have out of one cabin?
Well, around the main cabin, probably about four, but around the head, hill cabin, two, and some years more loops than that, and some years less. Just depend on how the game ran.
Well, these lines out of the cabin, the ones that can make around 51 days.
Yeah, that was the idea.
I wanted to ask you now, you mentioned in the first part of the case that you had bought dogs or something from a Jim Berry in the Custer Glen?
No, I didn't buy any dogs from him, but I visited him. He was living at Lakeview, Oregon at that time. That was 1936, as I recall. And he gave me more information about Alaska in a week or so I was with him than I've ever had since.
That was my grandma.
That's right, I know.
Mm-hmm.
You're telling about there's no 40-hour work week, which we normally think of trapping in the wintertime only after the 1st of November or thereabouts. How were your summers occupied?
Well, if you're really going to make a success of the trapping, your summers are occupied in getting up wood and cutting out new trails or brushing out the old ones and repairing your equipment and resting and getting in supplies and things like that, exploring new territory. And you can be working 365 days every year if you really want to.
Now, you had four dogs, and how did you get your dog feed at Beaver? Did you buy
Knitted myself, and some I bought from the groceries in the form of cornmeal, and some I bought from the local Indians, dried fish, and then I would take it up in a boat.
How far away from Beaver?
About 90 or 95 miles. That is by water. Overland, it's, I don't know. Well, how far would you say? Might not be more than 30 miles.
But no road.
No road. No, you have to fly. The only way you can get there is by flying if you don't go by boat.
How long did you spend in the bush at a time before you came outside?
The last year I was there full time, which was 1965, as I recall, I went up to my trap line on the 13th of September, and I didn't see another human being until about the middle of March. And two men from Fairbanks came in to see how I was. They were headed down to another camp below me, and then I came out. I had made previous arrangement with the pilot to pick me up the 15th of April, and I came back in a day or two, and I stayed out then until the middle of June.
Did you buy the Iron Dog?
No, I haven't bought the Iron Dog. I'm not very much interested in Iron Dogs. I've had lots of trouble with those outboard motors, and to me, an Iron Dog is just another outboard motor. it has its place, I'm quite sure, but I just don't want to fool with one. For one thing, I just don't see how I could keep warm on one of the things. Without skin clothing, you're going pretty fast, and they don't have a windshield, and they're in that part of the country. A windshield would be hazardous because limbs and falling and bent over trees and so on would be striking against it. I'm afraid it would break, or might not break, but just cause the limbs to strike you more solidly. And then the snow would fall down onto the thing, and I would just be frozen all the time, even if the weather was mild.
Well, Jeff Davison uses one
at the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. Well, he might have a different situation. I don't know. And Fabian Carey had one, I know. But last time I was talking with him, he was a little bit disillusioned with his, I think. Last winter he ran into a situation there he couldn't use it for some reason. Maybe there wasn't enough snow. I don't remember. Or maybe there was too much. I guess the rivers didn't freeze over, and he had to travel on foot. Forgotten exactly what his difficulty was, but anyway, he wasn't able to use it.
How many years has it been now that you had to change those caches?
Well, ever since I've been in the country, but it seems to get worse all the time.
80 miles.
Well, Mr. Lardy was referring to the ones in town.
The main camp. Mm-hmm. Well, you didn't have trouble with wolverines. You didn't have trouble with bear. But I'm sure that there are people who are interested, at least I'm interested, in, are there any particular animals that you found were a more challenging to trap than others, I guess?
Well, I suppose the... I never trapped any wolves. There's never been any wolves in the country, but they would be the most challenging animal to trap.
The wolf.
Uh-huh. And next to that would be the fox. No, they don't have any fear of a trap. They're so bold and so aggressive that they don't fear anything.
Well, I've seen where they've even, after they've stuck in the trap and have their foot cut, they chew their own foot off.
Well, that's quite possible. I've never had that happen, but I've heard of it. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't be felt. Now, where do you sell them? Do you bring them in town, or
well, no, what I generally did was take them to Fort Yukon, although I've sent some out to the Seattle Fur Exchange. The fur market is diminishing all the time. It's more and more difficult to find a satisfactory buyer. All in all, I think the Northern Commercial Company in Fort Yukon has been the best market.
Fairly recent arrival to Alaska, who's a trip up to Nome today, by the name of Charlie Geltman. He tells me that the Eskimos in Siberia, that there is a shipping into Central Europe, where they're then sent over to New York and then to Seattle, and then they're shipped up to Nome, where he sells them to the Eskimo there. Isn't it true for that?
No, I wouldn't know, but it sounds like it. I know, at least I think, that there's quite a lot of imported furs coming into the country from Russia or Siberia or some such place. But I thought that we were tied up with some sort of a treaty with the Canadians, and they in turn were dealing with the Soviet Union and so on. But I really don't know. But I think there's quite an influx of imported furs. But where they're coming from, I really don't know, nor what the circumstance is.
A number of years ago when I was in Barrow, why they supposedly shipped in $40,000 worth of fur from New York. And of course, I know at Nome, a lot of the seal, you see the seal that has that golden color? Well, that's from Norway, that's Norwegian seal. I'm sure there must be some more interesting questions.
No, I rather doubt it, because the rabbit cycle has been very low the last several years. The lynx cycle will coincide with that, and it will take several years, two or three years, for both cycles to build up again. I would say about 2 or 3 years from now should be a good lynx cycle.
I'll ask you the same question do you have the same opinion that Fabian Carey has about living out there with the animals, so to speak, and continuously at war with them? Do you ever have any feeling about killing off all of these animals for their health?
Well, I believe that you do have a few qualms eventually, especially if you have made quite a good catch. I've had other trappers say the same thing, that they kind of regretted killing them all. But then on the other hand, look at it in a more practical standpoint. They're a product that is to be harvested just like anything else, and if you don't harvest it while it's wasted, the laws of nature are not very very lenient. One animal kills another, and they don't kill as cleanly and as quickly and as painlessly as a man will kill an animal. So I feel that the wildlife is put there for our use, and we might just as well use it.
Now, when you're out trapping, you went out in September, I believe it was, you didn't return until early in the spring. What did you eat out there? Now, the reason I ask this question, in my younger days when I was down in Talkeetna, a trapper went out, and he lived the entire winter on the stuff that he carted out on his back, and it was a slab of bacon, lots of oatmeal, cornmeal, and a few flour, I guess it was, and a few things like this, and the fellow seemed to live. Now, do you live off the land to a big extent?
Well, not to, other than meat. Of course, most of your meals are built around moose meat, and I was lucky to get moose. In fact, I hunted hard for 2 weeks and without making a kill, and then killed a moose within 50 yards of my cabin door. That's just the way it goes. That's the primary thing. That is the one essential is meat. I don't know. You seem to crave meat when you're out that way. And then I netted quite a few fish, and I had plenty of rice and beans and canned food like tomatoes and peas and so on. And you can get lots of dried fruits and dried vegetables and condensed instant things, you know. But rice is one of the good ones. Cheese. So I think I had quite a varied menu.
You mean no sourdough?
Well, sourdough is. That's kind of a passé as far as I'm concerned. I never cared much for sourdough anything.
Are there any cases of scurvy amongst trappers?
I don't think so. That happened years ago when the Arctic explorers, when the whalers were in the country, and early gold miners. But I don't think, what with vitamin pills and all that, I just don't think that there's any such thing in the country anymore.
Possibly the meat isn't even entirely well done.
Well, I think that scurvy was caused more from salt meat and sourdough and beans.
No vegetables.
What was the process you used in preserving the hides and skin?
Oh, you don't have to worry about that. You just skin them off the animal, put them on a stretcher, and a few days they're dry. Mm-hmm. And then they're
salt them down?
No.
A thing that may interest you, that a number of years ago, I got a hold of some mink pelts that had newspapers folded and stuffed inside of the mink pelts, and the newspapers are 1926, I believe it was, 25 and 1926. And I don't know if those are good pelts or not. You recommend that I sell them, they apparently are still marketable, and they're pretty old pelts.
Well, here we don't have the moth problem like you do in some parts of the world. You can keep, if you use a bit of judgment and keep your furs out where there's air circulation, you can keep them for quite a while, I mean several years. But there are, under some circumstances, there are moths. And there's other things that work on fur. For instance, squirrels, these parka squirrels, spruce squirrels, they like to get into fur, and they trim them off and use the hair for the fur for their nests and so on.
Now, on the cabin, you would go out there. In your particular case, you purchased the cabin. But these trappers' cabins and line cabins that are located out in the wilderness, how are they constructed? I presume that nearly all of it is constructed on the spot. That is, the cabin is no better than the skill of the builder.
That's true. Generally you're there only overnight, and so you don't waste too much time. You have a little stove, little sheet iron stove there to keep it warm. Your bunk is just far enough away from the stove so you can lay there in the bunk and put wood in the stove, which is very handy, as I know. So some of them have windows, but lots of them don't too. So it's something to get you by during the overnight time, just while you're there.
Last summer you made some comments about or in fact, on this very evening, you made comments about the forest fire which nearly burned into your cabin. And last summer, you made some comments about some of the trapper boys up there who found finished wood so valuable that they disassembled or took the flat part off of the floor, I think, out and the windows out and put them in the river. What did you relate to that? I think that's great.
I mentioned this Dick Morris, from whom I bought this trap line. And sometime during World War II, I don't recall the year anymore, but a bad forest fire came into that country, and in fact, it was right up through his cabin there. So he didn't think that he was going to be able to save the cabin. So he tore out the floor and took out the windows and put them down in the river so that that they wouldn't burn. You see, a saw board in a country like that is quite a valuable piece of goods, and a window, too. So he knew that he could build another cabin if he had the hardware and the windows and the floor. Of course, I think that a cabin without a floor is a pretty poor habitation. Even you can, even if you have to make a floor of poles, it's still better than no floor at all. And he'd gone quite a bit of expense to get these windows and that sawn lumber there, so he wasn't going to let it go up in smoke if he could help it.
These forest fires that you have reference to, what effect did they have upon the game population, the fur-bearing animal population?
Well, in my area, it was just confined to a short distance, a small area, maybe 200 or 300 acres. It just so happened that we had the river here on one side, and then we had a small stream that wound around here on the other. And there was only one particular spot where the forest fire could get through. And luckily, the Forest Service over in Fort Yukon saw the smoke, and I think some pilot going over alerted them to the fact. And the man who was in charge at Fort Yukon was savvy enough to put these men, I think he only had two then, two men at this particular spot where the fire could get through, break through. And he did, and they were able to contain the fire, so it didn't, it really had no effect, no bad effect on the wildlife. But it caught my cabin on fire several times. I had quite a chore getting it out.
In your lifetime as a trapper, the period that you trapped and were familiar with trappers in the North, were there feuds amongst trappers? Was there a trap line jumping, one trapper getting on another man's trap line? And if so, what action was taken?
Well, I've never had any experience with feuds. I guess that there was. In Fort Yukon, there was years, many years ago, there was two men that went out and never came back. That is, they were trap line neighbors, and the supposition is that they got into a fuss and shot each other, killed each other. But I don't know. And I think that most trappers respect the other man's line. If he's got out his trails and his traps and so on, they're going to keep shy of him, because after all, the country can produce only so much game, and there's probably not enough for two, so there's no use of both of you starving to death when one might make it pretty well. Let's see, somebody else doesn't crowd in. No, I don't. I think that feud business is might have happened in years gone by when fur was at a high price and trap lines were more common than they are now, and harder work and so on.
Do you think that there, or I should say this, what do you think of the future as of the professional trapper?
Well, I think that as a profession, I think it's almost passé, but you must realize that even today, I think Alaska trapping produces about a million dollar industry even today, with depressed prices.
There probably will always be professional trappers because they are loners, and this is a way of life.
So. Well, they're escapists, and they prefer to be out there, and they trap more or less as a sideline. Some of them have to trap in order to make a living, but I think that's with old age and Social Security and old age pension, Social Security, and so on. It's becoming less and less a have-to thing. But I believe that there'll always be some fur here in Alaska to take, and there'll be men to take it.
To what extent is recreational trapping been
growing? Well, I wouldn't hardly know. I don't think that it's been increasing any. I think, or rather, that there's so many other things for a youngster to spend his time on now. The snow goal is allowing him to go out into more country, but I just don't believe that sport trapping is on the increase. I might be wrong, though. You think it is? Well, there could very well be.
What material was your canoe made out of?
Well, it is dried spruce wood frame and a canvas cover, and painted canvas, and the canvas is given a coat of paint or two.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any difficulty going down larger rivers for that?
Oh, yeah, that's too small for a large river. The one that had the rats in the bottom. Yeah, that's really too small. That's only about 9 feet long, as I recall. It's very good for lakes and still water, but you get out on the Yukon, for instance, or out where the wind has a sweep at you, and it's too dangerous.
Charlie, we've taken the trapping pretty well. Possibly there's more questions. If there are not, you might. Tell us about your trip from Old Crow to Beaver, and that was a very small boat you made that trip in.
Yeah, but it was larger than the one that was shown there. It was about 13 feet long. This trip, as I recall, was made about 1951 or two, somewhere in there. And I caught the brainstorm, the riverboat brainstorm at Fort Yukon, and prevailed upon Kurt, the skipper, to give me a ride to Old Crow, which he did for $25. And I took this canoe along. In fact, I bought it there from the trader, just on the spur of the moment, because I had this chance to make his trip. So I came back on the boat as far as New Rampart House. There was a family named Frosts at Old Crow then, and after I'd stayed there several days, they were coming back to Fort Yukon. They were coming to Fort Yukon to pick up their year's supply, so they insisted that I ride with them down to New Rampart House. And then from there on, I came on in to Fort Yukon by this canoe.
That's a clear river.
Very beautiful river. The Porcupine is a clear river, and it has nice wide bars, practically the whole distance. After, maybe one or two days from Fort Yukon, but the upper part of it is a beautiful river.
Do you have any trouble with game wardens and related things?
No, I have never been visited by a game warden out on the trap line area, but Well, they still do. They used to and still do come around and tag the beavers in the spring. They have to be, you can have them tagged at the local level, but in order to sell them, I believe it is, they have to be sealed. So, but if you want to sell them and send them into a fur dealer, well, he'll have them sealed. But the game commission will be around. They will seal the beaver that the traders have in the local area, and they will seal your beaver too at the same time if you want them to.
This is, of course, October 24th, 1968. Is this, what's the price of fur today? Do you have any idea?
No idea, really, right. But I can guess and say that it's pretty well down.
When you say it's pretty well down, you spoke of a beaver that was a blanket beaver, a dollar an inch. What has it been recently?
Recent years, that same beaver would bring you $25 if you were lucky, and $20 if you were not so lucky.
You not any gold mines?
No, I've never been in, not in Alaska. No.
Now, what's a fox skin worth today?
Well, I'm just guessing, but I sold, 3 or 4 years ago, I sold a nice silver fox, about as nice as you'd see, for $4. And I sold a red one at the same time for the same price.
When you sold that fox for $4, did you think about taking a gold pan with you?
No. That area that I'm in has been prospected years before. In fact, Joe Ledoux and two others of his companions, I'm not sure, but it was McQuestion and perhaps even Harper, spent a winter on Beaver Creek before even Circle. And it's been thoroughly prospected in earlier days, and I just don't think there's any gold in the area.
Well, I've seen blanket beaver sold for $125 a
pound. Yes, but not lately.
No, a big black Martin for almost $175.
Well, you'd be lucky to get $15 for the Martin now.
What is the sable worth about now? Is that it worth any more?
Well, as far as I know, there is no sable in Alaska. It's a Martin. It's practically the same thing as a Martin, but it's a European animal, really, real sable. So I really don't know, but I think they come from Siberia or perhaps the Scandinavian countries.
There's a lot of
them
from Labrador.
Are there
fisher? No fish in Alaska.
Are the land otters plentiful in the interior?
No, they're very scarce. Even in the Yukon Flats, they're very scarce. In Fort Yukon, I've checked with the buyer there, and he never gets half a dozen a year.
This would be principally then a coastal animal.
Yeah.
What kind of big game did you encounter other than moose? With a bear?
Bear, yeah.
What, blacks or grizzlies?
Both. They're both blacks and grizzlies. I've never had any experience with grizzlies, but mostly blacks. But there are grizzlies in the country, and there's three or four phases of black bear. There's a brown bear, which is just another black bear, but he's brown colored. But there are a few grizzlies, too. But they keep more to the higher country, I think. No caribou. There haven't been any caribou in there for 30 years or more. No. No, they used to come through there. In fact, they used to come right through Beaver Village. They've even come through Fort Yukon, but they don't come that way anymore. They come up the Porcupine River. They go from Fort Yukon to the Porcupine to kill, to make their moose, their caribou kills, but they haven't been any close by for a long, long time. I think probably it's the feed conditions that govern. There's not much caribou moss in the Beaver Creek country.
Well,
I think so. No, I never noticed anything that way. But these cussed little spruce squirrels have fleas, and so do these do the lynx, and some red fox have fleas, and they're quite vicious. Oh yeah. That's now,
so and obviously you've had experience with this, and you've gone out there trapping, and you probably didn't take any red fox flea powder with you. How did you cope with this?
Well, I just got to the brilliant idea of just leaving these animals hang until they'd gone through several days of real cold weather, and then the fleas don't bother anymore. They freeze out. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever cook any of these animals? For instance, we know Oliver Morris, for instance, tried to eat a lynx. At least one of them wasn't very good, but he found many of the younger lynx to be quite choice.
Well, I've heard how good lynx meat is, but I never tasted it, and the smell is enough for me. I don't mean it smells bad, but it just... something of a glorified cat smell, but I just never got that hungry. Yes, but I can't say that I care anything for it at all. Well, it's all a matter of taste, but I just don't care for it. I never ate that. Never tried it.
No.
However, there's one animal that is very good eating, and a good many of the people, old-timers especially, whom I have talked with, have failed to note the fact, and that's these little spruce squirrels. They're very good. Yeah.
I imagine the muskrat. Did you ever eat the muskrat?
Yeah, well, they taste pretty much like duck. Well, I didn't know that they were on the proscribed list. Oh yeah, lots of ducks and geese. Thousands of them, really.
When you were out in the summertime making trails and related things, did you use your dogs and packs for your dogs?
No. A dog, it can handle a pack, but it's not very practical. The way he steps and the way the pack sways and so on is, it's not very good. He's pretty awkward with a pack, and I just had no occasion to have him out that way. But I had one dog that I used to put some traps on when I was riding in the spring before the ice went out, and had him carry the traps to a certain extent. But it wasn't too good, wasn't too practical.
You ever catch your dogs?
Oh yeah, they once in a while they would disobey me, and they had to learn the hard way.
How did you arrange to feed your dogs during the time that you went away?
Well, during the summertime, I would board them out. That's a common thing. To leave them at the village there with some of the local people, and they would feed them for me $5 a month, as long as they would have a fish wheeling connection, and so they weren't out anything because they fed them a fish offal. But they're always a problem. They're just like a boat down the southeast. You have to be there all the time, or have somebody there to look after it. And
how about porcupines and dogs?
Well, they don't mix very well, but fortunately, there weren't very many porcupines in my area, and I always tried to keep them down. I had one dog that got a mouthful of porcupine quills, but I was right there at the moment, and I was able to pull them out without any difficulty.
This is, of course, a swamp, apparently. Lots of geese, you have beaver, muskrats, and related things. You live there in the summertime, apparently. You must have had a continuous battle with mosquitoes. How do you cope with
that? Well, you just learn to live with them, that's all.
There wasn't any particular... Now, we're speaking of... I imagine, what did you have at that time? 1949, was there a... Still, the
UHAC was good and still is. I think it's one of the best preventatives that there is. But
you mean you're not like Governor Hinkle going back to Chicago until all the tourists to come up in September to get away from the mosquitoes?
No. I'm afraid that you can't wait till September to get certain things done.
Month of the year.
Well, that all depends on your point of view and the locality. But if you're going to let a mosquito buzz by you and set you wild and start slapping every time you hear one, why, you'll soon be driven to distraction. But you just ignore them. They don't really bite so bad. Well, I've heard about the mosquitoes that were so thick that you couldn't see the sun, and that they kill dogs and all that, which I believe, but I don't think they've been that bad for the last 40 years. And there are some years when there's hardly any mosquitoes. It all depends on the season. If the country is dry, if the weather is dry, why they don't breed so thickly, and it takes those little tundra pools that to keep them alive. And if they're dried up, why, they don't have the breeding space, and they're not so bad those years. And anyway, by the 15th of August, they're generally pretty well dried up and pretty well out of the picture. Gnats, yeah, well.
What type of fish do you have there?
Pike and small white fish and large white fish, a few loss.
No grayling.
That's a freshwater cod. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No grayling in that area. I think there's grayling. I don't understand it. I've never seen any grayling in that area, but I know that they go up toward the headwaters of the creek. I mean, are up there. But whether they come out of there during the winter, during the fall, and go back and forth, or whether they stay in that particular area, I don't know. But there's none down there where I am.
So wash the same as a burbot?
Pretty much, I guess it is a burbot, yeah. It looks very much like a codfish, like a black codfish, except the color is a little different. I've forgotten what the color is. It's more of a tawny color, I believe, more of a smoked leather color, as I recall. Well, the ones that I've seen there have only been 2 feet or something like that. Pretty small.
Well, yeah. That's a pretty good fish. Beautiful fish. We talked about dog food a little... Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
We talked about dog food a little while ago. Did you use cornmeal?
Yeah, to a certain extent.
Now, did you ever use meat? Or were you cornmeal and fish?
Well, I used cornmeal and fish and generally some tallow mixed with it and trimmings from moose parts. And fish, even green fish that hadn't been dried.
When you speak of a green fish now, is this a fish that's not rotten?
Not processed.
Or, I say, not dried.
I was kind of
curious as to
why you communicate
on. Well, one time I ran in. I ran into a stick. It was a little bush kind of stuck out over the little old stream that I was in, and hooked into my shirt and my life jacket, and that turned me over. Kind of pushed me this way and then jerked me this way, and before I could get myself adjusted, well, it upset me. Well, the other time I was, I had too much load for the little canoe I was in, and I was crossing the Yukon River. You see, when you're traveling upstream, you've got to take advantage of the slack water. The water on this side may be too strong, the current may be too strong for you to stem, but on the other side, it's probably slack. So I had to cross the river to take advantage of the slack water, and before I could get across, the wind caught me, and it just was more than I could cope with. And well, I lost my gun and cameras and clothes and things like that.
There's a trapper, I'm interested now in your summer operation as well as winter operation. Do you always plan on carrying your gun with you?
Well, pretty much so. I always just a little bit timid about leaving the cabin too far without some kind of a gun along.
When you speak of a gun, are you speaking of a rifle or a pistol or a
gun? Yeah. Or sometimes, one or the other.
Is there
rifle or pistol.
Favorite rifle used by trappers, or are they, does each trapper have a different preference?
Well, I think that probably most of the trappers in this area would prefer a 30-06 rifle. The ammunition is easy to get, and there's a lot of varieties of firearms that handle that caliber, and it's adequate. And that's more than you can say for some of the lighter guns, like the 30-30. And I believe that that's the most practical size for Alaska, for the interior Alaska.
Charlie, did you ever regret the 10 years you spent as a professional trapper?
No, I wish I had come in 20 years sooner. I never left my cabin up there that I didn't regret leaving it.
What did you do with the carcasses of these animals?
Well, some of them you can put right in the dog feed. And for instance, rats and beaver, why, if I had more than the dogs could eat at that time, well, I just hung them up and dried them for future use.
When you say rat, you mean muskrat?
Muskrat, yeah. Yeah. Well, you do have flies, but if you wash, the flies are attracted by blood, and if you wash the blood off, and or if you, and they're only attracted during a certain time of day. If your meat or fish gets a little crust on it, why, the flies are no longer interested. So if you could hang your meat or fish up after the flies have settled down for the day, by next morning before they come out, by the time they come out, the meat or fish has a crust on it, and they're not much interested anymore. But you have to be a little careful to see that all parts of the meat or fish are where the wind has access to it. In other words, if you got something down, laid down against a pole, why, the flies will blow under there if you're not careful. Of course, the fish that we put up like that are not for human consumption, just for the dogs, and you don't have to be too particular for that. If you're going to have it for human consumption, why, generally start a fire, keep a fire going. Yeah, well, it's the same thing. Well, the man, a dog is a dog. He's not particularly, not particular about what he eats. You take it. For instance, you try to keep their pans clean and their grub clean, and you put them here into the pan, and the first thing you know, they'll jerk it out and throw it down here on the ground and wad it all around in the trash and dust and dirt and sand. And
how do you do? My name is Fabian Carey. I am going to take up with you the subject of trapping and the history of the fur trade in the interior of Alaska, particularly in the Yukon and Kuskokwim River valleys. This period extends over a relatively short period of time as compared with the great American fur trade. There is little written record of this trade other than in company and commercial records, which don't go back much before the early 90s or late 80s, as the Yukon River Valley, with the exception of the Canadian trade, which extended down the Porcupine River Valley and up into the upper Yukon as far as Fort Reliance for a period of 40 years under the aegis of the Hudson Bay Company, didn't really amount to anywhere near the There is a little written record of the history of the fur trade in this area, other than commercial paper, company records, shipping receipts, and dimming memories of what few participants still remain. I consider myself an amateur historian and a participant in this matter, and thus propose to combine experience and speculation in this discourse. It's safe to say that most of the fur produced in the Yukon Valley and the Upper Kuskokwim as well before 1890 were produced by the natives, for the simple reason that few white men were in the country, and few of these followed the fur trade, but were more apt to be on the trail of gold.